is episode 78 and explores chapter 2 of Tony Rossi and colleagues' book, Workplace Learning in Physical Education, Emerging Teacher Stories from the Staff Room and Beyond. This week I'm delighted to welcome Amanda Stanek as the practitioner responder, and I thank her for her considered words and for taking the time to respond. The words you hear in the response are Amanda's, but the voice is mine. I hope I do justice to a sentiment. This is an audio version of the PEPRN blog that can be found at www.peprn.com. What is professional workplace learning? The world has changed in many ways, and yet the way people are socialised into a profession or a trade has persisted. Most people would struggle to win an argument that insisted that what happens in the workplace of a lawyer, a doctor, or a teacher were in any way, or many ways, similar. In contrast, few would struggle to win if the argument revolved around the clear need for people to engage in workplace learning in order to move into these professions. The point of access for most professionals is via a legitimate workplace. This is where their induction occurs and where qualifying begins and continues. It is where, after a period of monitoring, mentoring, and guiding, an individual starts to be able to call himself or herself a beginner. From there comes an induction and/or probation period. For a teacher in the UK, this is the NQT or newly qualified teacher year, where further standards have to be met. It is only then, and over a protracted period of time, that professionals are considered as experienced or even expert. This is a model of professional qualifications that was established in a world where advanced economics were defined by manufacturing industries, industries that are now almost exclusively found in the developing world. Furthermore, economies are no longer really measured or even governed at national levels. Things have changed, and that change, indeed change more generally, has become one of the persisting elements of the modern world. The truth is that what is done has changed considerably, but the way that people are prepared for this changing world hasn't. Given the supply, in physical education at least, of aspiring teachers, employers and the gatekeepers who control pre-service teacher places, physical education teacher education, PEET, and school-based programmes, are likely to seek out recruits who already understand what they will be required to learn. Worryingly, given the manner in which the world has changed, what is valued is how one is and should be, as well as what practices and spaces are legitimised or not, including those practices reinforced in education, credentialing processes, and the shape of the professional for and by its members. In other words, what has occurred before becomes legitimised as the accepted practice of the membership. Be that within PEET, workplace learning as a pre-service teacher, or NQTs, and or later as experienced or indeed expert teacher stroke mentors. For me, example would be the prospective teacher's knowledge and competency of a particular sport. The preparation of physical education teachers does not occur, however, in isolation or in a vacuum. Instead, it occurs at a time when teachers and schools are repeatedly audited. Consequently, new teachers are required to learn in a community itself under pressure from the burden of expectation, such as success in school sport, high scores and grades by students in the high-stake senior programme, and minimisation of costs associated with running the HPE department. Teachers do what needs to be done, and pre-service and beginning teachers are expected to do the same. Taken alone, that would be complex enough, but learning is no longer confined to the working day. The divide between work, leisure time, unpaid work, family time and education is barely discernible, and work is now free, it seems, to spill over into other facets of people's lives. The boundaries of work have become at least blurred, and yet we accept this. We accept this because work has become one of the key indicators of good citizenship, and to be out of work is seen as a serious social stigma. We accept that learning is more than learning generalities, but is now about picking up routines and watching and copying colleagues in the same context. Significantly, these ways of learning are far from uniform, even for pre-service teachers in the same school or on the same teacher education programme. This is a very different form of learning to the one that most children experience at school, i.e. one where they are continually pushed through the same curriculum in institutional forms of learning, doing the same tests at the same time. Teachers are expected to learn how to respond in institutional ways to given situations, while still having the flexibility to react. They are required to know the techniques, skills, and procedures of their school so they can react accordingly to common events. This is not so they remain uncritically on message, but so they can react appropriately and quickly to uncommon or novel events that might occur. To do this, they need to practice. That is not to say that new teachers simply absorb what they need to learn and regurgitate it. They learn through a structured yet individually specific approach to learning that includes organised mentoring, assessment of task performance, competency and skills inventories, and so on. These approaches are far from uniform and are contingent upon the degree to which the school itself is a dynamic site, generative of serious intellectual questions about the nature of teaching and learning. The school is not, however, and as we discussed last week, a single space. Instead, it should be considered as a loose hodgepodge of groups who are competing for students' attention, for funding, and for recognition. There are implications for teachers who are required, expected, and mandated to learn and qualify in the diversity of these conflicting spaces. Implications that centre on safety, their safety. Workplace learning is dependent on the specific workplace climate because it is only when this is safe that it becomes and remains favourable to learning. If it isn't socially, emotionally, spiritually, relationally, and or physically safe, then it can have a devastating effect on any teacher, let alone novice and beginning teachers. Indeed, any work environment that is doubtful or uncertain will likely provide opportunities to learn that are defensive or evasive. Significantly, the very process of becoming a teacher is dominated by a small number, two or three maybe, of spaces and two particular phases, i.e. the school experience practicum and the first year of teaching. Within these wider spaces, the subject department staff room, or PE office, is the space more frequently occupied by novice teachers. This is, however, one of the spaces we know least about, especially how it operates as a professional learning community and how this affects the process of becoming a teacher or learning to teach. In Australia, the most entrenched criticism of teacher training relayed to its practical component. Even if this criticism is only a shadow of the global picture, then it still raises questions about the whole process and the unquestioned need for workplace learning in the professional qualification of a teacher. It is clear that the subject staff room or office, and particularly its culture, is a key factor in facilitating a positive and productive professional development experience, and yet we know so little about it. In many cases, it could be argued that it affords new teachers with outstanding learning opportunities. It might also be argued that in many cases it gives new teachers a taste of the real world. Equally, that taste could be unsupportive, questionable, abusive, and filled with language and practices that ridicule others because of their sex, sexuality, culture, religion, and/or body shape. This would not be a new story. As a subject, physical education has been described as insensitive to social issues, elitist, sexist, anti-intellectual, and full of pragmatic skeptics. Learning informally as a member of a workforce is something that individuals will, in different guises, spend more of their life doing than learning in formal settings. They will learn to play the game, and they will learn the language and gestures of the workforce. This is to be expected, but shouldn't we be more aware of what this means for new teachers, and eventually for the young people they will teach themselves, be they new teachers themselves or students? It could be argued that this hasn't been important before, given how little we really know. Surely it's time that changed. Practitioner Response by Amanda Stanek. Thank you, Ashley, as usual, for a very thoughtful post and congratulations on your new website. I also would like to thank you for the invitation to respond to this week's post. The day anyone in a school community forgets how much he or she has to learn is the day that a school fails to meet its potential and students are not served optimally. A growth mindset shouldn't just be a worthy pursuit for students. It should be modelled by every member of the school community. It should be an expectation. Regarding thoughts on novice teachers, I might add that equal support should be provided for the experienced teacher. You see, education is an evolving discipline, And this leads to why your blog is so great. It helps disseminate research to practitioners. Experienced teachers deserve to have time to process research, plan and modify practice, and reflect on their experiences. Otherwise, how will they improve? I've observed school leaders load experienced teachers with extra duties and assignments because they are so effective. This leads to burnout, high stress levels, and ultimately losing some of our best teachers who move on to other careers. I get really annoyed when we talk about experienced teachers as being lazy, and novice ones as needing all the support. Think about our students. We can't generalise them. We have to know each of our teachers as individuals and create a system that supports them so that each one can reach her stroke his potential, just as we aim to help students do the same. Pre-service teachers can be better if assignments during peak programmes are authentic, focus on critical thinking, and provide them with access to plan, implement, assess and reflect on activity-based courses. Opportunity for debate, case studies and other student-centred teaching strategies should be normalised in these programmes. Moreover, peak professors should not only be well-versed with the latest research, they should work diligently on their own teaching effectiveness, as well as to develop and maintain an effective, positive and collaborative relationship with the government physical education professionals. Many PE teachers feel isolated and work as the only PE teachers in their schools. In fact, at least in North America, it is very common for elementary PE teachers to teach in multiple schools. Thus, the opportunity to learn in PE offices simply doesn't exist. Another issue is that PE teachers are often serving students during their non-instructional time. Intramurals anyone? Coaching duties anyone? Effective PE teachers support students' physical literacy development in many ways, which decreases opportunity for them to engage in professional dialogue with PE teachers and other content area colleagues during a school day and before and after school. Of course, there are other ways of reaching out to have your thoughts questioned. We met through Twitter, and I joined Twitter while off on maternity leave as I missed the professional dialogue with colleagues I had as a Key 12 PE teacher and peak professor. Yet, of the absolute best PE teachers, I've only met very few of them on Twitter. I completely disagree with the idea that the best teachers are on Twitter and cringe when I read this. It's an ignorant statement. How PE teachers are evaluated often leads me to wonder if they mean anything. Take tenure and promotion in the higher education system, for example. How can a biology professor evaluate the contributions of a PE professor, given the service load of a PE professor, who is supervising pre-service teachers, running service learning programmes as part of the pedagogy classes, etc.? While some might have this right, it's an area that needs a lot of work. I've exceeded the word limit, so will regrettably stop here. I could think as I tap my keyboard for many more paragraphs. What I love most about what I do is that it forces me to think and grow. It's so exciting. I wonder how powerful it might be if individuals who read this post challenge themselves to learn something new each day, and to challenge someone else in a thoughtful, kind, and intentional way each day. I suspect that less ego, more action, and more quality PE would result. Amanda Stanek, MoveLiveLearn.com. So in concluding, how does this discussion relate to you, to your experiences? Did it make you think or consider something? I'd love to hear your thoughts and so would others, so please share at www.peprn.com. Thanks for listening, and see you next week for the next Pepin podcast, where I'll discuss the next chapter of Rossi and colleagues' book. Acknowledgements. I would like to thank Amanda for her response and for taking the time to reflect on the blog. I would also like to thank Vicky Goodyear for her work behind the scene as copy editor. Her help certainly forms a vital part of the production of this podcast and in getting it out on time and in a semblance of coherence. However, it is important to note that any mistakes that remain are mine. Thank you.